the urge to jump into, and I follow him. The water is startlingly cool when I dive in, but when I come up for air, I can feel my face is flushed. What is going on with me? I'm not usually this impulsive.
Nice dive, 8 says, swimming over and treading water close to me. He shakes his head and his black, glistening curls whip around his head.
So, do you prefer being called Marina or 7?
I don't care. Whatever, I say, feeling shy.
I like Marina, he says, speaking decisively for both of us.
Is this your first time in India, Marina?
Yes, I was in Spain for a long time, in an orphanage.
An orphanage, huh? At least you had lots of kids around you. You can make friends. Not like me.
I can see how lonely he's been. I decide not to correct him and tell him how all the girls hated me and I had no friends until Ella showed up. I just shrug.
I guess I'm happier now.
You know what? I like you, Marina, he says. It sounds like he's rolling my name around in his mouth, savoring it. You're quiet, but cool. You remind me of... Suddenly, there's a huge splash right between 8 and me. The waves rock us away from each other, and I watch 6 emerge, her wet blonde hair falling perfectly down her back. She doesn't say a word, then dives back underwater, pulling 8 with her. I dive too and watch them wrestle underwater until 8, laughing, begs for mercy and 6 lets him go.
Damn, you're strong, he says as he breaks the surface, coughing. And don't you forget it, she says, grinning. Now can we please get out of here?
The sight of 6 and 8 all tangled up makes me jealous. But this is not the time for it. I duck my head underwater to give myself a minute to pull myself together. I let the water enter my lungs and I sink and sink until my toes touch the muddy and rocky floor. I sit down in the mush and try to collect my thoughts. I'm angry at myself for feeling so vulnerable. This is a crush, nothing more. And do I really care if 8 prefers 6's perfect blonde hair to my mop? I mean, she isn't a threat to me. We have to work as a team, trust one another. I don't want to be angry with 6, especially after everything she has done for me. For a minute, I pace around the bottom, hoping to come up with something witty to say when I surface. I can do this. I realize I'm directly under the spot where the waterfall enters the pool, where the water is clear and sparkling. The glint off something catches my eye. It's a long silver object stuck in the muddy floor. I go to take a closer look. It's maybe 15 feet long, and when I circle it, I'm stunned to realize it's some sort of cockpit behind a long windshield. That's when I see a chest, just sitting there on the seat inside. I can't believe it. Is it possible that this is the silver ship that 8 saw fly away the day that the Moogs attacked? The day that his Saipan was killed? I hear a muffled cry and realize it's mine. I grab a handle on the fuselage and pull. It doesn't budge. The pressure at the bottom of the lake is so strong, but I keep pulling, and soon the cockpit door swings open. A rush of water mixes with the water that was trapped inside. The chest is slimy when I grab it, and race for the surface. The first thing I see is 6 and 8 sitting in the grass and talking. Ella is twirling 8's walking stick over her head, then out in front of her. Creighton is watching Ella, his chin cupped in his hands. Ella sees me coming out of the water and spikes the stick into the grass.
Marina! She calls.
Hey, there you are. Where'd you go? 8 yells, coming over to the edge. Come on out, Marina, 6 calls. We really have to boogie now. I lift the chest up and out of the water, holding it aloft so they can all see it. I don't even care the most revolting mucky water is pouring off of it and onto my head. I am grinning so wide my face hurts. I love the looks on their faces, mouths agape and eyes wide.
I'm enjoying it so much. I use my telekinesis to float the chest over to 8 and 6 and leave it there in mid-air. Look what I found, 8! 8 disappears from the grass and reappears up in the air next to the chest. He wraps his arms around it and hugs it, slime and all. Then he teleports back to the edge of the lake, the chest still in his hands. I can't believe it, 8 finally says. All this time, it was right here. He looks stunned. It was inside a moke ship at the bottom of the lake, I say, walking out of the water. 8 disappears again and teleports directly in front of me, our noses practically touching. Before I can register how nice his warm breath feels on my face, he picks me up and kisses me hard on the mouth as he twirls me around. My body stiffens, and I suddenly have no idea what to do with my hands. I don't know what to do at all, so I just let it happen. He tastes salty and sweet at the same time. The whole world disappears, and I feel as if I'm floating in darkness. When he sets me down, I pull back and look into his eyes. One glance, and I know this huge romantic moment was a spontaneous and grateful gesture for him. No more, no less. I'm an idiot! I really need to let this crush go. I never swim over here. From the start, I always dove off on the other side there, 8 says. Stuck in the same area. He shakes his head. Thank you, Marina. You're welcome, I whisper, still dazed by the first part of his thank you. Now that you've hugged it hello, don't you want to open it? Creighton asks. Come on already! Oh, right! Of course! 8 yells, and he teleports back to the chest. 6 walks towards me. Marina! That was so awesome! She hugs me, then pulls away to shake me by the shoulders, smiling at me meaningfully. In a low voice, she whispers, And am I seeing things, or did you just get kissed? Kind of weird, right? I whisper, watching her for any signs of jealousy. But I don't think it means anything. Not weird at all. I think it's kind of great, she says. Clearly thrilled for me, like a friend or a sister. I'm ashamed of myself for feeling jealous of her earlier. We both look over at 8 as Ella begins to make a drumroll noise to announce the chest's opening. 8 has his palms on the lock. Almost immediately, it shakes and the chest falls open. He quickly dives in, elbow deep, trying to touch everything all at once. He's like a kid in a toy chest, he's so excited. We all crowd around and watch. I can see some of the stones look like mine, but other items are completely different. There's a glass ring, a curved antler, a black piece of cloth that shimmers blue and red when 8 touches it. He grabs a thin piece of gold the length of a pencil and holds it up. Ah, good to see you again. What is that? 6 asks. I don't know its real name, but I call it the duplicator. 8 holds it above his head like a wand. Then he snaps his wrist and it expands out and down, like a scroll. Soon it's the size of a door frame. He lets go and the frame hovers in front of him. 8 steps behind, and we can see the occasional pair of hands and feet when he starts doing jumping jacks. Okay, 6 says. That is the weirdest thing I've ever seen. 8 teleports to her side and stands there, head cocked to the side as he scratches his chin, like he's judging a show. Our heads snap back to the golden doorframe. The hands and feet are continuing their steady pace. Wait, there are 2 of him now. The one standing next to 6 claps, opens his palm, and the piece of gold contracts and zips back into his hand. Immediately, the second 8 disappears. Impressive, Creighton says, clapping his hand slowly and loudly. That will come in very handy sometime soon. At the very least, you will make an excellent distraction.
I used it to sneak out of our house a few times, 8 admits. Reynolds never figured out what I could do. Even before he died, I was always trying to figure out how to do the most with my legacies. Creighton throws 8's clothes to him and picks up my chest. Now we really need to get going.
Aw, come on, 8 says, pulling on his pants as he hops about.
He bats his eyes at Creighton and says in a wheedling voice,
I just got my chest back. Can I get reacquainted with it? I've missed it so much.
Later, Creighton says curtly. When he turns towards us, though, I can see he's smiling. 8 drops a piece of gold inside the chest and pulls out a green crystal, stuffing it into his pocket. He closes the chest and picks it up with a dramatic sigh. In his most pathetic voice, he says,
Oh, all right. Our reunion will just have to wait. Follow me, everybody.
How often has Cetricus Raw visited you in your dreams? Creighton asks.
We've been walking more than 5 hours, and we're making slow progress up the mountain.
8 is leading us up a winding path that is more ledge than road. There's a thin blanket of snow everywhere, and the wind is brutally strong. We're all freezing, but 6 protects us with her legacy, pushing the wind and snow out of our way. Weather control is one of the more useful legacies, that's for sure.
He's been talking to me for a while now, trying to trick me and get me to lose my temper, 8 says. But now that he's on Earth, it's a lot more frequent. He taunts me, lies, and now he's trying to get me to sacrifice myself so that you all can go back to Lorien.
He's been getting to me more than usual lately.
What does that mean, exactly? Getting to you? Creighton asks.
Last night in a vision, he showed me my friend Devdun, hanging from chains. I don't know if it's a vision or something that's actually happening, or just a trick, but it's really messing with my head.
Force sees him too, 6 chimes in. 8 spins around with a surprised look on his face and walks backwards, his mind clearly putting the pieces together. His foot comes dangerously close to slipping off the ledge, making me gasp and reach out nervously. But he never wavers as he continues.
You know, I think I saw him last night. I forgot about it until now. He has blonde hair. Tall guy?
And better looking than you?
Yep, that's him, 6 says with a smile.
8 stops backpedaling and looks thoughtful. The drop-off to our left is almost 2,000 feet.
You know, I always assumed it was me, but I guess I was wrong, he says thoughtfully.
Assumed you were what? I ask, willing him away from the edge.
The member of the guard who would possess Pittacus Lore's powers.
Why would you think that? Creighton asks.
Because Reynolds told me that Pittacus and Cetricus Ra were always able to communicate with each other. But now that I know 4 can too, I'm confused.
8 starts walking forward again, when Ella asks,
What do you mean, possess Pittacus Lore's powers?
Each of us is supposed to take on the roles of the original 10 elders, so I guess that means one of us will take on Pittacus's powers and role, 6 explains.
4's Saipan told him so in a letter. I read it myself. Eventually, we're supposed to become even stronger than them. That's why the Moogs are moving so quickly now, before we become more dangerous, better able to protect ourselves and attack them. She looks over at Creighton, who is nodding as she speaks.
I feel like I'm the only one who knows so little.
Nothing, really, of my history. Adelina refused to tell me anything, to answer a single one of my questions, or even hint at what I would one day be capable of. Now I'm so far behind everyone else. The only elder I even know of is Pittacus, never mind knowing which one I might become. I just have to believe I'll figure out who I am when the time is right. Sometimes I get sad when I think about everything I wish I already knew, and when I think about what my childhood should have been. But there's no time for me to mourn what can't be changed. Ella comes to walk with me, brushing her hand against mine.
You look sad. You okay?
I smile at her. I'm not sad. but I'm mad at myself. I've always blamed Adelina for why I haven't developed my legacies the way that I might have. But look at Eight. He lost to Sapon, but took what he had and just kept working at it.
We walk together in silence for a few more minutes until Eight speaks.
Do you ever wish the elders had given us our inheritance in locked backpacks instead?
Eight says, switching his chest to the other arm.
I look guiltily at Creighton. I move to take my chest from him, but he just pushes me away gently.
I have it for now, Marina. Soon enough, I'm sure, you'll need to bear its burden alone, but I'll help while I can.
We walk for another few minutes until the path along the ridge suddenly ends at a steep cliff. We're a few hundred feet from the peak, and I stare over the Himalayas spread out on my left. The mountains are vast and seem endless. It's a breathtaking sight, one I hope I'll remember forever.
So, now where? Six asks, looking skeptically up at the mountain. There is no way we can go straight up the peak.
There don't seem to be a lot of other options, though.
Eight points at two tall, hulking boulders leaning against the mountainside, and then clenches his hand. The boulders separate, revealing a curved stone staircase that winds around and leads inside the rock face. We follow Eight up to the stairs. I feel both claustrophobic and vulnerable. If someone follows us, there's no way out.
Almost there, Eight says over his shoulder.
The stairs are so cold. Their iciness seeps up through my feet and body. They finally lead us to a huge rock cavern that has been carved out of the mountain. We pour into it, gazing around in awe. The ceiling is a couple hundred feet high, and the walls are smooth and polished. Carved deep into one of the walls are two sets of vertical lines several feet high and spaced 5 feet apart. A small blue triangle sits between the two lines, with three more curved lines carved horizontally above it.
Is that supposed to be a door? I ask, following the lines with my eyes.
Eight steps aside to let all of us see better.
It's not supposed to be. It is a door.
It's a door to the far corners of the earth.
Chapter 14. I pull my hoodie up over my head and hunch my shoulders. Nine's wearing a dirty Cubs cap and cracked sunglasses, items he found in the train yard where we jumped off. After an hour's walk south, we're standing against the wall of a platform, waiting for another train. This one is elevated. The L, as Chicagoans call it. The chests in our arms stand out against the other passengers' briefcases and backpacks, and I do my best to act casual. Bernie Kosar sleeps comfortably inside my shirt, now a chameleon. Nine is still kind of pissed that I was skeptical that anyone would put a safe house in such a densely populated area. I know Henri would never have chosen such an exposed place. We don't speak as the train rumbles into the station. Bells chime, the doors slide open, and Nine leads me into the last car. When the train pulls away, we watch the city of Chicago slowly grow closer.
Just enjoy the view for now, Nine says.
He looks more and more at peace the closer we get to the city.
I'll tell you more when we get off.
I've never been to Chicago before. We pass what feels like a million apartment buildings and houses as we clatter through the different neighborhoods. The streets below are full of cars, trucks, people, dogs being walked, babies being pushed in strollers. Everyone looks so happy and safe. I can't help but wish I were one of them. Just going to work or school, maybe for a walk with Sarah to get a cup of coffee. A normal life. Such a simple idea, but it's almost impossible for me to picture. The train stops. People stream off and others push to get on. The train gets so crowded that two girls, a blonde and a brunette, are forced to stand practically leaning over us.
Like I said,
Nine says, smiling happily.
Just enjoy.